individuals and calling them by name. General Grant will be in this city within the hour. If this house is harmed, your houses shall be burned down by noon." The crowd dispersed. For Van Loo, the Union occupation of Richmond was redemption as well as vindication. U.S. Grant sent her a letter stating, "You have sent me the most valuable information received from Richmond during the war." Townspeople were first astounded and then irate to learn the extent of her operations in the capital. Ostracism and poverty were her lot until she secured a brief position in the Richmond office of the Freedmen's Bureau. In 1869, President Grant added insult to injury for local citizenry when he appointed Van Loo postmaster of Richmond. The position was one of the highest federal offices a woman could hold in the 19th century. Not only was the salary substantial, but also the postmaster dispensed patronage by hiring postal employees and controlled the dissemination of political information. Further, the position was often a stepping stone to better federal ones. During her 7-year service, Van Loo diligently ran an honest enterprise. She introduced home delivery of mail inside the city limits while championing racial equality. Nevertheless, she could not escape her wartime deeds. She was a living reminder of Reconstruction. Citizens emboldened by the Lost Cause creed, headquartered in Richmond, humiliated her at every opportunity. She received constant and repeated gross personal insults. When her mother died in 1875, Van Loo stated that "we had not friends enough to be pallbearers." Her appointment as postmaster expired with the Grant presidency. Conciliatory Rutherford Hayes named a less controversial figure to oversee Richmond's postal affairs. Financially strapped, Van Loo moved to Washington in search of another postal position. She obtained only a low-grade clerical position, and when an unfriendly superior demoted her to the dead letter office, Van Loo left the government and returned to Richmond. She became a frail and bedraggled figure in a dilapidated building that once was an ornate mansion. A group of Massachusetts citizens, remembering the kindness she had shown their soldier sons, sustained her financially with an annual payment. Her last years formed a vicious cycle. She became a recluse. When she went out publicly, she was suspicious of the intentions of everybody and fled home. On September 25, 1900, Van Loo died of edema, dropsy. Few people attended her burial in the family plot of Chaco Hill Cemetery. Since the family gravesite lacked sufficient room, the coffin was buried vertically rather than horizontally. Fitting for someone who had thrived in a world where nothing was as it seemed. George Edward Pickett, remembered for one attack. Pickett's charge is the most famous failed assault in American military history. This is perhaps not surprising, since the man for whom it is named possessed more than his share of personal problems. He overdressed and on occasion over-imbibed. Beneath the ostentation, Pickett was a mediocrity, and his post-war fortunes would not alter that view. Born in 1825 on a large plantation downriver from Richmond, Virginia, Pickett had a highly unusual record at West Point. A brilliant but lackadaisical student, he graduated last in the class of 1846 and was only 5 demerits shy of expulsion. Pickett did serve well in the Mexican War, but his 1851 marriage to Sally Minge ended a year later when she died in childbirth. Pickett was so devastated that he took a 4-month leave of absence from the Army and seemingly lost his flair for combat. In 1857, while on frontier duty in the Washington Territory, he may have married a Haida Indian princess named Morning Mist. Local residents strongly support the tradition. Although the couple had a son, the mother died from the effects of childbirth. How Pickett felt about the loss is unknown, for he abandoned both his home and the boy. The coming of the Civil War sparked Pickett's return to Virginia. He received a colonel's commission and was placed in charge of defenses on the lower Rappahannock River. In February 1862, his promotion stemmed more from the need for brigadier generals than from any accomplishment by Pickett. He was a colorful figure among his fellow officers, outgoing with a romantic mustache and perfumed curly hair. He showed promise in the opening phase of the Peninsula campaign against Richmond. On June 27th at Gaines Mill, while exhibiting less than inspiring leadership, Pickett suffered a shoulder wound that left him impaired for several months. During his convalescence in Richmond, he met LaSalle Corbell, the highly educated daughter of a Virginia planter who was 23 years his junior. Pickett would leave camp in the middle of the night to see the girl he had every intention of wedding when she came of age. They maintained a steady flow of love letters even after their September 1863 wedding. Pickett had no chance after the 7 days' campaign to distinguish himself. Quite the contrary, he twice was rebuked for inept supervision of his troops. The same carelessness and inattention at West Point had carried over into his war career. Nevertheless, thanks to his close friendship with General James Longstreet, Pickett was elevated to Major General and Division Command late in 1862. He had seen no action for a year when his turn in the limelight came on the afternoon of July 3, 1863, at Gettysburg. Lee ordered Pickett's men to spearhead an attack on the center of the Union lines. Pickett allegedly responded first by writing his fiancée, "My brave Virginians are to attack in front. Oh, God in mercy, help me as he never helped before." Then 14,000 Confederates surged across an open wheat field 3/4 of a mile wide. Vicious fighting occurred for 40 minutes. On the slaughter ground, Pickett lost half his command, including every general and field officer save one. The stunning defeat permanently sapped much of Pickett's limited ability. Worse, when Lee rejected Pickett's official report as being far from factual, a coolness developed between the two leaders. Assigned thereafter to command the lawless Department of North Carolina, Pickett met another defeat at New Bern and compounded the loss by brashly hanging 22 deserters as their families and friends watched in horror. Nervous exhaustion removed him from field duty for the remainder of 1864. Pickett rejoined the army early in 1865 and assumed command of Lee's right flank. His instructions were to hold his position at all hazards. On April 1st, with no action occurring between opposing lines, Pickett rode to the rear to enjoy a meal of baked shad. That afternoon, thousands of Federals under General Philip Sheridan assailed Pickett's leaderless position. Half the Confederates surrendered. The remainder fled to the rear en route. Lee promptly removed Pickett from command. A week later, the war ended at Appomattox. Without a home and penniless, with the army the only job he had ever known, Pickett had no idea what to do next. He, his wife, and son were forced to flee to Canada when a congressional committee seemed on the verge of indicting Pickett for war crimes because of the North Carolina hangings. Pickett's old army friend, U.S. Grant, interceded to obtain a pardon and a release from court trial. The ex-Confederate tried a number of occupations and failed in each. He finally found some stability by selling insurance for a New York firm with an office in Norfolk. Pickett remained quiet in the post-war years while other military leaders were writing articles, producing memoirs, or traveling on the lecture circuit. Still, he couldn't forget the nightmare of Gettysburg. In 1870, he agreed to accompany Colonel John S. Mosby on a courtesy call to Lee. After they left the meeting, Pickett spoke bitterly of that old man who had my division massacred at Gettysburg. Mosby, ever supportive of Lee, replied, "Well, it made you famous." On July 30th, 1875, Pickett died in Norfolk from what the death certificate stated was abscess of the liver. He was buried with the thousands of other Confederates in Richmond's Hollywood Cemetery. From that point, LaSalle Corbell Pickett was determined to bring order and fame from life's disappointments. She spent the remaining 50 years of her life transforming her husband's reputation as a mediocre officer into one of the Confederacy's greatest heroes. Stage performances and veterans' meetings set a base for voluminous writings that contained fabrications, romanticized tales, and widespread plagiarism. The results were the ruined reputations of both writer and subject. George Pickett, however, did have one post-war moment of truth. Former Confederate officers were gathered at a Richmond meeting when an argument began over who was responsible for the defeat at Gettysburg. Was it Lee's error of judgment? Longstreet's slowness? Stuart's absence? One man looked over at Pickett, standing nearby, and asked his opinion. Pickett quietly replied, "Well, the Union Army had a hell of a lot to do with it." Wade Hampton, South Carolina Redeemer. Wade Hampton was reputed to be the largest landowner in the antebellum South. He certainly held that distinction in his native South Carolina. His father and grandfather fought in America's first two wars. They accumulated cotton plantations in South Carolina and Mississippi, as well as a sugar estate in Louisiana. After graduating from South Carolina College, Hampton studied law before devoting his full attention to the family's holdings. He considered public office an obligation rather than an opportunity. In 1852, he began 7 years of service in the two houses of the state legislature. His was a lone voice of moderation amid a rising chorus condemning abolitionists and northern usurpation of the law. Hampton stated in 1859, "Unless every patriot in our land strikes once more for the Constitution, I see not how the Union can be or should be perpetuated." He followed the state's exodus from the Union and enlisted in the Army as a private. Governor Francis Pickens made him a colonel and asked Hampton to raise his own command. Hampton reacted like a patrician warrior. At his own expense, he marshaled his neighbors, family, and even some of his slaves, as body servants, into a combination of infantry, cavalry, and artillery known as Hampton's Legion. Blessed with intuitive leadership qualities and a fighting spirit, Hampton commanded with a calm, confident manner. He was tall and well-proportioned, with a mustache and mutton chop whiskers. His dark eyes had a peculiar snapping motion. His voice, one soldier recalled, was tenor and ringing. Rarely did Hampton display excitement. The hotter the fight, the cooler he seemed to become. Steadily, he evolved into one of the great cavalry officers of the Civil War. Hampton was conspicuous in every battle of which he was a part. By 1863, he was one of two brigade commanders in General Jeb Stuart's mounted arm of Lee's army. Hampton suffered his first family tragedy at the June 9th Battle of Brandy Station, when his younger brother was killed in the action. The relationship between Stuart and Hampton was not close. The two men had contrasting personalities, with Stuart tending toward the flamboyant and Hampton more introverted. State rivalry also played a role. After one engagement, Hampton declared, "I suppose Stuart will, as usual, give all the credit to the Virginia brigades. He praises them on all occasions, but does not often give us credit." At Gettysburg, Hampton's fellow brigadier, Fitzhugh Lee, ordered a cavalry charge in Hampton's absence. The Carolinian rushed into the field to rally his men. He received two saber strokes to the head as a result, and a surgeon had to shave half of Hampton's skull. The general took it good-naturedly. "Striking, if not beautiful," he wrote of his injuries, "although the flies play the mischief as they wander over the bald side." It took Hampton 4 months to recuperate. He gathered fresh troops from South Carolina, returned to duty, and spent the rest of the war confronting threats and staging raids. His victory over General Philip Sheridan at Trevilian Station was a badly needed success during Grant's 1864 Overland Campaign, when Stuart was killed at Yellow Tavern in May, Hampton move up to command all of Lee's cavalry. The September beef raid was his most publicized feat. Confederates rode 100 miles in 12 hours and captured 11 wagons plus 2,468 cattle that had been grazing only 6 miles from Grant's headquarters. The meat fed Lee's army for a month, and the hides filled a critical need for foot covering. In another engagement a month later at Hatcher's Run, Hampton's son Preston fell mortally wounded while his father was directing the action. Hampton rushed to the youngster, held him in his arms, and murmured, "My son, my son." The general kissed the boy and returned to the battle. Hampton was recruiting at home when, in January 1865, he was promoted to lieutenant general. He became one of but 3 Southern generals without formal military training to attain that rank. The war ended before Hampton could return to Lee's army. The once wealthy planter faced widespread destruction from Sherman's forces, as well as personal poverty. "He looks crushed," a neighbor stated. "How can it be otherwise?" The ex-general accepted Confederate defeat, but he never conceded that the Southern cause was wrong. Like Robert E. Lee, Hampton went to work to rebuild his home country. "The very fact that our state is passing through so terrible an ordeal as the present," he stated, "should cause her sons to cling the more closely to her." Radical Republicans levied heavy Reconstruction on the South. Hampton toiled constantly to redeem and reunite the Union. He declined offers to run for governor because he sought to strengthen the Democratic Party into an acceptable alternative for Carolinians. It was in their interests to remake the South, Hampton believed, for as the country prospered, so would its people. At every mass meeting, Hampton urged freedmen to join Democrats for the common good of the state. One observer mistakenly thought such an action was a waste of time. "General Hampton and his friends," he declared, "had just as well try to control a herd of wild buffaloes as the Negro vote." In 1876, Hampton won election as governor, with a margin of victory of only 1,134 votes. In spite of his detractors, freedmen made the difference. The new executive became known for racial moderation and honest fiscal policies. Shortly after his reelection, Hampton was thrown from a mule while hunting, and his right leg had to be amputated. He was bedridden when he learned of his election to the U.S. Senate. He served in Washington for 11 years, but his first speech was the most remembered. When a Northern senator made a slur against the South, Hampton was quick to respond. "In the heat of conflict, we struck hard blows, and doubtless we spoke harsh words. But does remembering or repeating them now bring us any nearer to the peace and harmony for which the whole country so ardently longs?" Hampton then expressed the wish that more veterans were in Congress. "We learned in a common school how to respect our enemies." President Grover Cleveland appointed Hampton as Commissioner of Railroads. It was largely a ceremonial position, but Hampton took the post seriously, traveled by train from coast to coast, and made several recommendations for improvement. With his health beginning to fail, he declined William McKinley's offer of reappointment. The Carolinian died April 11, 1892, of vascular heart disease. He is buried in Trinity Episcopal Church Cemetery in the capital of the state that he loved so deeply. The most radical of the secession states received an uplift by Wade Hampton in the critical post-war years, but South Carolina returned to the Union on wheels of conciliation and white supremacy. Francis Redding Tallulah Nichols, Louisiana's honest politician. Francis Redding Tallulah Nichols rode a bandwagon of reform and popularity to post-war success in Louisiana. He did so in part from having donated 2 appendages to his country. He is an excellent example of how losses in war can prove to be gains in peace. Born in Donaldsonville, Louisiana, He graduated from West Point in 1855 and had the distinction of being the only Pelican State native in his class. Nichols spent a year in service before resigning because of gastrointestinal problems. He obtained a law degree from the University of Louisiana, now Tulane, and enjoyed a successful practice until the outbreak of the Civil War. His marriage to socialite Carolina Guyton produced 7 children and financial security. Nichols's West Point training led to his appointment as Lieutenant Colonel of the 8th Louisiana. His first battle action came on May 25, 1862, at Winchester, Virginia. A bullet shattered his left elbow and led to his capture. The wound stopped bleeding on its own, which saved his life, but 4 days of inadequate treatment followed before a Union surgeon amputated the limb. Nichols was given only whiskey as anesthesia. Recuperating at home, Nichols received a promotion to Brigadier General and joined Robert E. Lee's army just in time for his second engagement, the 1863 Battle of Chancellorsville. He was trying to bring order to his confused command in deep woods when a cannon shell ripped through his horse's stomach and struck Nichols' left foot. The general reached down in the darkness and was shocked to find his foot gone. The leg was amputated a few hours later. Nichols had engaged in 2 battles and had lost 2 limbs. A wooden leg and 1 arm holding a crutch hampered him for the remainder of his life. Carried to Lynchburg, Virginia, to recover from his wound, Nichols refused to be treated as a cripple. He sought and received appointment as post commander of the rail town, with its prisoner of war compound and 5 military hospitals. Knowing that Lynchburg might well be a target in the 1864 Union offensive, he began military preparations. He first impressed local slaves to construct fortifications along the main roads leading to the city. Next, he recruited locals too old or too young for regular service and drilled them regularly as militia. When a Union force did advance on the city in June, Nichols turned to the hospital population. He selected 1,300 convalescing soldiers who could stand and shoot. This group of walking wounded became his major defense line. One reason Nichols was successful in motivating men to the earthworks was because, according to one surgeon, he was a West Pointer and a splendid officer and gentleman. Confederate reinforcements arrived in time to repel the federal threat. Even so, the crippled general's preparations for a battle were instrumental in saving Lynchburg from probable destruction. Nichols enjoyed a quiet post-war law practice until 1876, when he was drawn into state politics. Reconstruction was ending because radical control in Washington was fading. On the national scene, Rutherford Hayes and Samuel Tilden waged a heated race for president. In Louisiana, Democrats at last saw a chance to regain political control. They proudly nominated all that is left of General Nichols for governor. The 1876 gubernatorial contest exceeded even Louisiana's penchant for wild politics. One historian concluded, "In such a mass of assertions and denials, bribery and counter-bribery, and of false testimony contradicted and retracted, the truth is well-nigh hopelessly buried." Nichols was able to keep most of his followers calm. He courted the black vote with assurances that the 14th and 15th Amendments would be implemented. Public funds from the powerful Louisiana Lottery helped finance his campaign to redeem the state from crooks and outsiders. Both sides claimed victory on Election Day, and for a while the state had 2 governors. Republican Stephen Packard refused to relinquish the office. In January 1877, Republican legislators barricaded themselves in a New Orleans hotel dubbed Fort Packard and admitted only Reconstruction-sanctioned representatives. Only weeks before the presidential inauguration in Washington, Louisiana politicians reached a compromise. Republicans duly elected would be allowed their seats in the legislature, the 2 constitutional amendments would go into full effect, and Francis Nichols would be recognized as governor. His inauguration brought the largest turnout in New Orleans since the announcement of the 1803 Louisiana Purchase. Nichols was one of several Southern Redeemers elected governor that year, seeking to end the reign of the radical Republicans. Their victories, coupled with the ascent to the White House of the conciliatory Hayes, enabled several states to return peacefully to the Union. Inside Louisiana, however, Nichols battled corruption left over from the Reconstruction era. The general ousted a large number of proven crooks. He chaired the Constitutional Convention that brought Louisiana into national alignment. The state capital was returned from New Orleans to Baton Rouge. Nichols continually promoted racial peace and honest government. He expanded state railroads and resurrected state militia. Rich and poor, black and white, were comfortable with state leadership under Governor Nick. At a large Confederate veterans convention in New Orleans, Speaker William Preston Johnston recognized Nichols, "whose maimed form and empty sleeve are on the platform." What followed was deafening applause. Nichols declined a second term as governor. He also refused election to the U.S. Senate. His return to private life was brief, for public demand sent him to a second term as governor. In 1892, he was offered the position of Chief Justice of the state's Supreme Court. Critics who asserted that Nichols was too one-sided to be a judge were ignored. Spectators always grew silent as two aides helped him mount and dismount from the bench. President Grover Cleveland recognized Nichols' merits by selecting him for a term on the West Point Board of Visitors. Nichols resigned from the court in 1911 because of declining health. Shortly thereafter, on January 4, 1912, he died from heart failure. His remains lie in St. John's Episcopal Church Cemetery in Thibodaux, Louisiana. One eulogist described him as a brave soldier whose life was one long battle. Yet that life had its rewards. He was the most impressive figure in Louisiana during the last quarter of the 19th century. Nichols State University bears his name. At the Capitol in Baton Rouge stands an impressive statue. It has its left foot, but the arm is only a flap. Chapter 3. The First Modern War. The paramount fact about Civil War battles, historian Alan Millett concluded, was that weaponry had outpaced tactics and communications. In 1861, regiments went into battle just as soldiers had done for centuries. Mass firepower and the threat of bayonets wielded in great frontal attacks decided the course of combat. A charging line had to be compact so that infantrymen could see or hear commanding officers giving battlefield orders. The charging file had to be small for the sake of coordination. During the Civil War, however, such assaults came to mean, as a Union officer wrote, a slaughter pen, a charnel house, and an army of weeping mothers and sisters at home. The huge armies of the Civil War demonstrated early that the traditional method of open charges was outdated, but no one could suggest an alternate method of attack. Further, the advent in the 1850s of the rifle with a range five times that of a musket provided a weapon that began to shift the advantage in battle to the defensive side. When Christopher Spencer introduced a rapid-firing carbine to the federal arsenal, his new technology elevated the killing process to a slaughterous level. Coinciding with more lethal shoulder weapons were sharp advances in how armed forces fought. William T. Sherman is often called the father of total war, even though fellow officers such as U.S. Grant, Philip Sheridan, and Judson Kilpatrick pursued identical practices. Sherman spelled out in writing his strategy on the eve of the March to the Sea campaign that extended from Atlanta to Savannah. If need be, Sherman stated, his army would take every life, every acre of land, every particle of property, everything that to us seems proper, that we will not cease until the end is attained, that all who do not aid are enemies, and we will not account to them for our acts. No longer a limited war between armies, the civil war became a fight to the death between peoples. Another innovation came about because of militarily untutored Bedford Forrest, whom one writer considers the great natural soldier of the 19th century. He was the premier cavalry commander in the Civil War, not just as a fighter, but also as a strategist. Unencumbered by old-school concepts taught at military academies, Forrest's strategy was the forerunner of World War II German Blitzkrieg. Infantry moving quickly by vehicle, attacking a surprised foe, and then racing away to the next target. While Forrest was often accused of using guerrilla tactics, the term would better be applied to those tactics of Confederate naval commander Raphael Semmes. The hopelessly outnumbered Southern Navy had to resort to privateering, in which single vessels roamed the sea in search of defenseless merchant ships. The wily Semmes, with his waxed mustache ever gleaming, was by far the most successful captain of the warships preying on supply boats. On the positive side, the Civil War mercifully brought major advances in the field of medicine. For every man killed in action, two died behind the lines from wounds and disease. Disorganization awaited injured soldiers brought to aid stations. Into the chaos in 1862 strode Dr. Jonathan Letterman. He single-handedly brought order, organization, and vastly improved medical treatment. His major contribution may have been the introduction of a battlefield ambulance corps. This may seem insignificant, but many wounded men lay unattended for days on a battleground. Letterman's ambulances gathered up the injured as soon as possible and rushed them to treatment centers. It is impossible to say how many thousands of lives were saved by the father of the emergency medical services. On a related improvement, little-known James Hanger supplied an important support to soldiers who lost a leg in battle. In one of the first skirmishes of the war, Hanger received a wound that led to the amputation of a leg. He scorned the usual peg leg given to amputees and carved a wooden limb that resembled a leg and was hinged at the knee. Hanger's innovation opened the door to a prosthesis industry that today supplies hundreds of thousands of maimed individuals who can live far more comfortably, thanks to the ingenuity of a teenage Virginia farm boy. The Civil War even brought an advance in the treatment of dead bodies. Thomas Holmes is regarded as the father of modern embalming and thus of the American mortuary industry. Every human endeavor opens the possibility of advancement, and an undertaker's business is the dead. Operating in Washington during the war, Holmes embalmed more than 4,000 bodies upon the request of the bereaved. The Civil War triggered the rise of the largest armies ever seen in the Western Hemisphere. In the case of the North, some 2 million men stepped forward to defend the Union. Of necessity, the four-year struggle brought significant advances in Army logistics. Equipping, feeding, and moving armed forces are fundamental tasks that require much attention and effort. The North was blessed with the greatest quartermaster general in our military history. Humorless but meticulous, Montgomery Meigs was indefatigable during the war years, orchestrating the acquisition and assignment of everything from cannon to nails. He spent more money than anyone else in the Civil War, and he could account for every penny of it. When a federal army moved, one could say General Meigs was moving with it. A major reason that supply lines became so fruitful was the railroads that carried them. Hermann Haupt became a model for future engineers in his ability to rapidly build rail lines, especially his trestle bridges. As a result, the railroad's capacity for carrying large numbers of people would become a standard element in mass troop movements all over the world. As the Civil War grew more intense, so did the killing power of weapons. Richard Gatling in 1862 invented the first machine gun, a six-barrel hand-cranked implement that could fire faster than a man can count. The Gatling gun was too problematic in design to be used extensively in the Civil War. However, it took a terrible toll among Native American tribes during the wars in the West. Continued improvements over the years have now made the Gatling gun one of the most feared weapons of all. The Civil War was a 19th-century watershed in the development of modern warfare. The days when ladies could come with their parasols to watch the brave boys fight, as occurred in the First Battle of Manassas, by degrees gave way to the soul-draining combat of trench warfare at Petersburg, the Confederacy's last stand. The bloodiest war ever fought on American soil changed forever the ways that armies all over the world marched into battle. Christopher Minor Spencer. What a difference a carbine makes. More than one writer has felt that Christopher Minor Spencer was the model for Mark Twain's A Connecticut Yankee in King Arthur's Court. The Connecticut-born farm boy relied more on incentive and intuition than on formal education. He lived in search of new ideas and solutions. At 13, using a handmade hacksaw, Spencer cut down his grandfather's Revolutionary War musket to carbine size. At 15, he built a working model of a steam engine. In his late 60s, he drove to work in a steam automobile. At the age of 87, he turned to aviation as a field for study and improvement. In all, Spencer would obtain 42 patents. The most memorable, if not valuable, was the breech-loading repeating rifle that changed the face of combat. Spencer spent his formative years as a journeyman machinist in a range of different plants. While employed in Hartford Textile Company, which sparked his invention of a silk winding machine, Spencer had a long conversation with Samuel Colt, in which the gunmaker commented on the Army's need for a new shoulder weapon. Spencer toyed with the idea throughout the late 1850s. His basic concept was a repeating rifle that would far outperform the single-shot muzzle-loading musket used for centuries by infantry. The Cheney brothers, at whose mill Spencer worked, were so impressed by Spencer's design that they bought the patent for $5,000 and a royalty of $1 for each gun sold. Spencer toiled night and day to perfect the rifle. John Hay, Abraham Lincoln's secretary, later termed the slightly built, bearded Spencer as a quiet little Yankee who sold himself in relentless slavery to his idea for 6 weary years until it was perfect. The weapon Spencer produced was a carbine with a barrel length of only 39 inches, compared with the musket's 48 inches. Instead of storing ammunition in a tube underneath the barrel, Spencer fitted a loading tube into the stock. It contained 7 .52-caliber rim-fired metallic cartridges inserted end-to-end. The gun chamber was loaded simply by working a lever below the trigger. Spencer's carbine could fire a sustained rate of 14 rounds per minute, as compared to the 3 or 4 shots of a muzzle-loading musket. It was a revolutionary weapon, hence it immediately encountered a major obstacle. The chief of the Ordnance Department was General James Ripley, an aged officer as rigid in obeying the military manual as he was opposed to inventions that altered standard procedure. Ripley saw little advantage in Spencer's invention, but fortunately, Abraham Lincoln did. The president was mechanically minded, as he showed early in adulthood when he obtained a patent for a device that allowed river vessels to pass more easily over shoals. Lincoln acquired a Spencer carbine and ran his own test. Affixing a wooden sight and tacking some congressman's letter to a tree, the president hit his target 75 feet away with around 12 of 14 shots. The Ordnance Department subjected the weapon to a variety of tests as well, and all were positive. The first order, with Lincoln's endorsement, was for 7,500 guns. Late in 1861, a second order went out for 10,000 more carbines. The Spencer Repeating Rifle Company in Boston was soon thriving. In August 1863, Spencer traveled to the White House to show the president an improved version of his gun. The two men walked down to a clearing by the Potomac River and took turns shooting at a target from a distance of 40 yards. Lincoln proved the better shot, whether Spencer intended it or not. Orders subsequently increased for the gun. Colonel John T. Wilder, a foundry owner before the war who commanded an infantry brigade, was so impressed by the Spencer that he took out a personal loan to equip all his men with the carbine. Each soldier agreed to pay for his weapon through payroll deductions. One of Wilder's veterans wrote, "Our men adore them as the heathen do their idols." An embarrassed War Department heard of the situation and bought the Spencers for the brigade. Confederates understandably feared the rapid-firing gun. They called Spencers weak guns because they were, said one Johnny Rib, "the damn Yankee rifles you load on Sunday and fire all week." The carbines became the standard arm of Union cavalry. Their short barrels, plus their ability to deliver volleys in quick fashion, made them ideal for mounted soldiers. On New Year's Day, 1865, General William Sherman's chief of cavalry wrote to a fellow commander, "There's no doubt that the Spencer carbine is the best firearm yet put in the hands of the soldier. Our best officers estimate one man armed with it, equivalent to three with any other arm. I have never seen anything else like the confidence inspired by it in the regiments and brigades which have it." Not until General Ripley's resignation in 1863 did production of the Spencer begin on a large scale. In all, Union soldiers used 1,304,000 shoulder arms in the Civil War. Only 106,600 were Spencer carbines, but their presence in battle had a noticeable and deadly impact. In the post-war years, Spencer could not keep pace against newer and better rifles such as the 1866 Winchester. 3 years later, the near-bankrupt Spencer sold his company to Oliver Winchester and his stock of carbines to the French government. Yet his inventive mind never rested. Forming a partnership with Charles Billing, Spencer made major improvements in drop forging, producing complex shapes from metal. He added to his new fortune with inventions in sewing machine shuttles and pistol frames. His 1873 invention of a screw-making machine guaranteed his lifetime wealth. The success he had known with the Spencer carbine led to the 1882 establishment in Windsor, Connecticut, of the Spencer Arms Company. What Spencer sought to do this time around was to create a revolving magazine shotgun. It would be the first slide-action or pump-action shotgun and would be available in both 10-gauge and 12-gauge caliber. The weapon, however, proved too expensive to manufacture. In 1901, Spencer designed a steam-powered automobile. He was dabbling with airplane development when he died January 14, 1922, at his Connecticut home. Spencer's inventions, stretching through the last half of the 19th century, made him a leader in the Industrial Revolution, not only in the United States, but also worldwide. Yet, in military circles, he will always be remembered as the man who invented the gun that ended the Civil War. William Tecumseh Sherman, leading the charge toward total war. He was Cump to his friends and Uncle Billy to his soldiers, who idolized William Tecumseh Sherman because he had a common approach and was a hard fighter. A lean six-footer, he had little eyes that rarely brightened and nervous hands that twitched at a scraggly beard. One Billy Yank found him boiling over with ideas while discussing every subject and pronouncing on all. To most historians, he was the Confederacy's worst fear, a ruthless general who waged all-out war as he burned his way through Georgia and South Carolina in the last year of the Civil War. But the portrait of the man is far more complex. Sherman's early years gave few clues to the reputation he would someday gain. Though he graduated from West Point in 1840 with high expectations, results were slow in coming. He spent 13 years at southern coastal outposts and in California, cultivating a host of friends wherever he went. By 1853, having risen only to the rank of captain, Sherman resigned from the army. He worked for a San Francisco bank until it closed. Louisiana acquaintances secured for Sherman the superintendent post of the State Military Academy. He did well at the Southern School, but as storm clouds of secession boiled overhead, he left the academy to become head of the St. Louis streetcar system. He wept at the news of Fort Sumter, but dutifully asked for reinstatement in the army. A colonelcy promptly followed. Sherman's solid conduct at the Battle of First Manassas 2 months later brought him promotion to brigadier general. However, the prospect of the long and bloody struggle ahead, the arduous task of converting uneducated volunteers into seasoned soldiers, and the assignment to backwater duties in Kentucky were more than Sherman could bear. He suffered a nervous breakdown. Newspaper reporters, whom he openly classified as snoopers and liars, gleefully announced that the general had become insane. Early in 1862, Sherman returned to duty and joined U.S. Grant's forces in the Western Theater. He served in all the major engagements on the west side of the Appalachian Mountains and became Grant's most trusted lieutenant. Of the close relationship between them, Sherman snapped at a correspondent late in the war. "He stood by me when I was crazy, and I stood by him when he was drunk. Now we stand by each other always." When Grant took over supreme command of the Union armies in the spring of 1864, he placed Sherman in charge of the Western Theater. The always unkempt Sherman conducted a less than brilliant campaign to seize Atlanta, but his attitude toward the war had undergone a sharp change. Sherman became convinced that military engagements alone would not bring down the proud South, and that war had to be taken to the civilian population via destruction of personal property. Break the Southern will to resist, and the Confederacy would die. "If the North can march an army right through the South," Sherman told Grant, "it is proof positive that the North can prevail." Once the South surrendered, he stated, he hoped to regain many lost friendships. What followed was the introduction of total warfare. Sherman left Atlanta in flames. His 60,000 veterans formed a 40-mile-wide prairie fire of destruction as they swept eastward toward the sea. The Union target, Savannah, fell without a fight. Sherman then proved a man of his word in regard to regaining friendships. His lenient treatment of Savannah residents went far in making defeat palatable. Federals then burned their way through South Carolina, the seedbed of the Confederacy, but exercised restraint during final operations in North Carolina. Sherman's scorched earth tactics certainly shortened the Civil War. On the other hand, his surrender terms were so tolerant that the Johnson administration rejected them while the press branded Sherman a traitor. He, in turn, refused to shake Secretary of War Edwin Stanton's hand at the May 1865 Grand Review in Washington. With victory secure, Sherman wanted all punishment of the South to cease. It was time to rebuild, he felt. This soft policy ran counter to the aims of the radical Republicans who ran Congress. Sherman was dispatched 1,500 miles away to command the Department of the Trans-Mississippi. However, in 1869, Grant, now president, named him General-in-Chief. Sherman held that post for the next 14 years. Unfortunately, his racial prejudices shone shamefully for a second time. On the march to the sea, the general had ignored thousands of runaway slaves trailing in the army's wake. His biases became more pronounced against Native Americans. Sherman declared, "Both races cannot use this country in common, and one or the other must withdraw. We cannot withdraw without checking the natural progress of civilization." On another occasion, he asserted, "We must act with vindictive earnestness against the Sioux, even to their extermination, men, women, and children." War against Native Americans characterized Sherman's long tenure as Army head. At the same time, he found himself continuously at odds with Washington bureaucracy. The mutual animosity was so great that he journeyed to the Capitol only when specifically ordered to do so. Republicans wanted to nominate Sherman for president, but he replied curtly, "I will not accept if nominated and will not serve if elected." Retirement from the military in 1883 made him one of the most sought-after speakers in the South as well as in the North. He could be expansive in his speeches. He stated at one commencement address, "War is at best barbarism. It is only those who have neither fired a shot nor heard the shrieks and groans of the wounded who cry aloud for blood, more vengeance, more desolation. War is hell." With his wife a crippled recluse, Sherman gained a reputation for womanizing. He maintained a long affair with internationally known sculptor Lavinia Vinnie Rehm. Early in 1891, Sherman developed a cold. Erysipelas of the face and nose developed, so physicians painted his head with the standard antiseptic of the day, iodine. The general had difficulty talking. On February 14th, a strong asthma attack proved fatal. He died in New York, but was buried in St. Louis. Not until the 20th century did historians and novelists like Margaret Mitchell and her Gone with the Wind turn Sherman into a callous conqueror of the South that he deeply admired. Yet he is remembered now as the general who altered war from a chess game of limited objectives into an open season contest. The enemy was not to be found just on the field of battle, but also in factories, barns, homes, and any other establishment that gave aid to its soldiers. The objectives of war had changed for good. The centuries-long age of sword and roses chivalry in war was now history. Nathan Bedford Forrest, the most feared cavalryman. Few generals in the Civil War were more celebrated and more feared than a premier horseman in the Western theater, Nathan Bedford Forrest. Admirers called him the Wizard of the Saddle and the world's greatest commander of mounted troops. Union General William Sherman labeled him that devil Forrest, but later acknowledged the cavalryman to be the most remarkable man our Civil War produced on each side. Bedford Forrest was born to a dirt-poor Tennessee family and received no more than 6 months of formal education. In 1840, he survived a typhoid fever epidemic that claimed three of his sisters and two brothers. When he was a teenager, Forrest assumed responsibility for the family. He moved to Memphis and established one of the largest slave trading businesses in the area. This prosperity enabled him to acquire extensive landholdings in Cahoma County, Mississippi. Success brought a number of public offices as well as a widely known reputation as a self-made man. 40 years old when the Civil War began, the tall, strongly built man with gray hair and a fierce temper enlisted as a private in the Confederate Army. He became a brigadier general within a year because of a combination of intuitive genius and demonstrated leadership. Forrest's patriotism had a fierceness. He made war with driving rage, never wavering from a basic premise. War means fighting, and fighting means killing. His tactics were unorthodox. If surrounded by the enemy, he taught his men to charge both ways. Forrest initiated the concept of galloping deep into enemy territory, dismounting his troops to fight like infantry, and then dashing back to safety. When once asked for the secret of his success, the cavalry leader replied, "I get there first with the most." He had little use for leaders who fought by the book. "Whenever I run into one of those fellers who fit by note," he commented, "I generally whip the hell out of him before he could get his tune pitched." 3 times he organized independent cavalry units. On each occasion, he made raids on isolated Union troops, command posts, and supply depots. His forays regularly disrupted Federal Army movements. The most famous and controversial of his raids was the April 1864 attack on Fort Pillow, Tennessee. Forrest's men easily overran the river earthworks and its garrison of white and black soldiers. The Confederates adopted a take-no-prisoners attitude, especially toward the black soldiers, and Fort Pillow thereafter became a synonym for massacre. While Forrest was a superb head of a large, independent cavalry force, he could never have commanded an army. Humorless and volatile by nature, he didn't get along with superior officers. He once threatened to kill Army Commander Braxton Bragg if he ever saw him again. Forrest did lead by example. Over the course of the war, he received 4 serious wounds, had 29 horses shot from under him, and personally killed at least 30 Federals in hand-to-hand fighting. By the end of the war, in May 1865, Forrest's men gave up because they were used up. The general himself was crippled by war wounds and recurring boils. Forrest announced to his troops, "Men, you may all do as you damn please, but I'm a-going home." He was physically broken and financially strapped, but he was determined to regain economic stability in his life. The slave auction business no longer existed. Little was left of his Mississippi plantations. Yet many of his former slaves refused to leave, and with their help and the financial assistance of 7 former Federal officers, Forrest enjoyed a modicum of success in late 1865. Personally, he became a model of reconciliation. The following year, however, Forrest was forced to sell the plantations and move to Memphis in search of other business opportunities. His personal struggles paralleled those of the South under Reconstruction. He was never able to readjust to the new realities of subjection. Paving streets and grading railroads were frustrating jobs that came and went. Forrest joined the Ku Klux Klan because he believed it to be a defensive, vigilante-type mechanism to keep the peace in an atmosphere of lawlessness. He was with the organization for only a year, leaving when the Klan turned to intimidation and terrorism to achieve its goals. Yet he never wavered from his belief that blacks and whites were not and could not be equal. Thus, while Robert E. Lee became the symbol of a reuniting country, Forrest was the embodiment of white supremacy. In July 1868, he finally received a pardon from the federal government. Forrest had by then become interested in the growing railroad industry. He jokingly told a friend that during the war he destroyed rail lines. Now he wanted to build them. Scraping together sufficient funds, he purchased a controlling interest in a proposed line, the Selma, Marion, and Memphis Railroad. He served 5 years as president of the developing rail line and in 1875 retired because of ill health. He mellowed with age and joined the Presbyterian Church. Although he lived comfortably, the general never recouped his pre-war fortune. Bedridden toward the end, he came to weigh less than 100 pounds. Forrest was 56 when he died on October 19, 1877, of chronic diarrhea. The general was buried in his Confederate uniform in Memphis's Elmwood Cemetery. With his burial, legends about him began and continue. On one reported occasion, Forrest was working on his farm. He allowed his favorite horse, King Philip, to graze in the front yard. When a Union cavalry company rode past the home, King Philip dashed toward the group, teeth bared and front feet flailing. As Forrest fought to restrain the animal, the Union captain shouted, "General, now I can account for your success. Even your horses fought for you." Other legends had a more factual basis. William T. Sherman, who regularly complained about that devil Forrest, supposedly said after the war, "Give me Union infantry and Confederate cavalry, and I can conquer the world." The Confederate cavalryman was the principal innovator of mounted infantry. He predated modern strategies that require mobile staging of troops, such as the German Blitzkrieg of World War II, by advancing rapidly with mounted infantry and enveloping an enemy position in a surprise, usually overwhelming, assault. Today's use of airborne infantry divisions is another extension of Forrest's principles. His tactics, one military analyst stated, were a preeminent example of warfare's evolution from heavy columns and clashing armies to speed, stealth, and subterfuge. Raphael Semmes, Last of the Great Pirates. The greatest commerce raider in American naval history, and certainly the Confederacy's most exciting naval officer, was Maryland-born Raphael Semmes. Orphaned at the age of 9, he and a brother were raised by two uncles. One was in merchant shipping, and the other was a successful attorney. Hence, young Semmes acquired an early interest in the sea and the law. At 16, he entered the Navy as a midshipman. That was a time of peace, and officers customarily received long furloughs without pay. Semmes used such periods to study law. Admitted to the bar in 1833, he established a practice in Cincinnati. When the Navy recalled him to permanent active duty, Semmes moved to Pensacola, Florida. He took his family to nearby Alabama, bought property and 3 slaves, and declared himself an adopted Southerner. Survey duties, lighthouse inspections, and commanding various ships in the Mexican War all preceded an 1855 furlough. While practicing law again, Semmes published a highly received memoir of his Mexican War experiences and rose to the rank of commander. Thanks to his 34 years of various experiences at sea, Semmes became one of the first volunteers accepted for the Confederate Navy. President Jefferson Davis named the 51-year-old naval veteran a commodore. Semmes immediately requested sea duty, and he and Secretary of the Navy Stephen Mallory agreed on a new venture. Semmes would command a commerce raider preying on loaded northern merchant ships. This type of warfare would inflict heavy financial damage, disrupt the flow of supplies, and draw Union vessels away from blockading duties. On June 30, 1861, Semmes steamed into the Gulf of Mexico aboard CSS Sumter, a small and slow 5-gun bark-rigged steamer. Still, given Semmes' daring, he sank 18 vessels in a year and eluded every interception by a Union warship. The Sumter experience brought him fame, but he learned 2 things. His tactics did not weaken the blockade, and many nations refused to let him bring a prize into port for adjudication. Semmes's cruises accelerated after August 1862, when he took command of an English-built steamer simply named Number 290. The 3-mast vessel was 220 feet long and carried 8 guns and a 120-man crew. Under steam and sail, it could slice through the waves at 13 knots per hour. When Semmes became its captain, he renamed the ship CSS Alabama. It proved to be the finest cruiser of her class in the world. Her skipper looked the role of a swashbuckling sailor, of medium height but erect bearing, with hard, dark eyes. Semmes wore his hair long and maintained a luxuriant mustache which curled up and far outward to waxed points. It gave old Beeswax a touch of flamboyance he had hitherto lacked. The crew was an international mix that required constant attention. I have a precious set of rascals on board, Semmes wrote, faithless in the matter of abiding in their contracts, liars, thieves, and drunkards. Yet Semmes was a stickler for discipline and order. He was also opinionated and wordy, as well as extraordinarily lucky. For 23 months, Alabama enjoyed spectacular success. It roved from one hunting ground to another, flying the American flag until close to a vessel, when the Confederate flag would suddenly appear, along with shots fired across its victim's bow. Occasionally, Semmes would have to run down a merchant ship. As he described one situation, "When the day dawned, we were within a couple of miles of him. It was the old spectacle of the panting, breathless fawn and the inexorable foxhound." In all, Alabama captured 64 ships and boarded 447 others. It had cruised 75,000 miles when, in June 1864, it limped into the harbor of Cherbourg, France, for refuge and repairs. Suddenly, USS Kearsarge appeared off the coast. It was large, trim, and recently outfitted with guns far superior to those of Alabama. Semmes sent out a message to the Kearsarge Captain John Winslow, with whom Semmes had served on USS Cumberland during the Mexican War. "If you'll give time to recoal," Semmes stated, "I will come out and give you battle." The June 29th duel lasted 90 minutes. As Alabama was sinking, Semmes noted proudly that, "We buried her at sea, safe from the polluting hands of the hated Yankees." Semmes made his escape to Southampton on an English yacht. He had the satisfaction of knowing that he was instrumental in driving insurance rates for American vessels to astronomical heights and toppling the American merchant marine from a once dominant position. Semmes returned to Richmond and a rear admiral's rank. He took command of the 10-vessel James River Squadron, which was destroyed in the April 1865 evacuation of Richmond. He accompanied President Davis to Danville, Virginia, where a makeshift government sought to keep the dream alive. Because sailors made up most of the military party and manned the artillery defenses, Davis thought it appropriate that Semmes be appointed a brigadier general. No Senate existed to confirm the nomination, but Semmes has the distinction of being the only American officer to simultaneously hold the ranks of admiral and general. On May 11, 1865, Semmes received his parole. He returned to Mobile and tried to find employment in a foreign navy. Yet nations were reluctant to incur the displeasure of the United States by hiring the pirate Semmes. 7.5 months after his parole, the admiral was arrested by order of Secretary of the Navy Gideon Welles. The charges were piracy and failure to surrender himself with the sinking of Alabama. Union authorities spent 4 months searching for incriminating evidence. When none materialized, Semmes was released. In April 1866, he again returned to Mobile. His naval service was always a negative factor in the search for a job. Reconstruction prevented him from practicing law. Mobile citizens elected him as a probate judge, but the Secretary of War declared Semmes ineligible. When he gained a teaching position at what is now Louisiana State University, northern newspapers howled at a pirate being allowed to teach a course on moral philosophy, and the appointment was withdrawn. In 1867, Semmes became editor of a Memphis newspaper. This afforded him time to produce Memoirs of Service Afloat, published in England and filled with Southern romanticism and anti-Northern rhetoric. He moved back to Mobile in 1869 and eventually became its city attorney. He was at his cottage at Point Clear across the bay from the city when he died on August 30, 1877, of food poisoning after eating tainted shrimp. The poet-priest of the South, Father Abram J. Ryan, conducted the funeral service at Mobile's old Catholic cemetery. Semmes was the most successful of 19 Confederate privateers. He alone was responsible for a third of all captures of Union ships. In the North, his name became synonymous with that of Blackbeard. The South viewed him as a swashbuckling conqueror at sea. To merchants who sent goods abroad, Semmes was a malevolent ghost, able to appear or disappear at will. For all their dash and style, however, the privateers had little impact on the outcome of naval tactics. They were insufficient in number, a nuisance more than a danger. Yet American maritime trade fell so badly that it took three generations for it to return to normal levels. Later, and on a more massive scale, German U-boat submarines prowling the Atlantic during World War II expanded the havoc caused by a lonely predator like Raphael Semmes. Jonathan Letterman, Mobilizing Medicine. The sea change created by one Civil War doctor can be shown in a single contrasting example. Following the 1815 British victory over Napoleon at Waterloo, it took 10 days to treat the wounded scattered on the fields. In 1863, after three vicious days of combat at Gettysburg, a surgeon reported that not one wounded man of the great numbers who had fallen was left on the ground. That extraordinary development in medical care stemmed from the work of Jonathan Letterman, who remains one of the true heroes of the Civil War and of mankind. He was the father not only of modern military medicine, but also of today's emergency medical system. Letterman followed in his physician father's footsteps. After graduating from Jefferson Medical College in Philadelphia, Letterman opted to bypass private practice and become an Army surgeon. He spent 12 years at far-flung outposts stretching all the way to California. The experience proved highly beneficial. Compelled by his circumstances, Letterman discovered the value of ingenuity. To use whatever worked rather than to adhere to guidebooks that said what should work. He was called east in 1861 and saw brief duty in Western Virginia until July 4th, 1862, when Letterman was appointed as a major and medical director of the Army of the Potomac. He was 37, little known, slight in build, and quiet by nature, with the earnest look of a student. His new responsibilities appeared overwhelming. The entire army was exhausted, emaciated, and dispirited. One of every three soldiers was sick or wounded. Wagons for hospital use had to be requisitioned from the quartermaster department and were always low on the priority list. Teamsters had no medical skills. Officers in the field paid scant attention to the needs of the wounded. Any medical treatment was minimal. The new major had long been filled with reform ideas. Now, with complete control over an army's medical needs, Letterman went to work on building a system where none had existed. Organization and common sense were the keys. His first accomplishment was the creation of an ambulance corps. Letterman cast aside the old two-wheeled quartermaster carts capable of carrying three men. Instead, he developed, solely for his department, a four-wheeled wagon with springs that could accommodate six men seated and three prone. Each wagon had a medical chest, and its teamsters were trained to handle injured soldiers. Letterman next organized a chain of treatment centers. Wounded men were initially taken to a regimental first aid station for examination. Those with serious injuries were